From Aspen Public Radio, this is Curated, stories on the art and the artists who visit and live in the Roaring Fork Valley. I'm Claire Woodcock, arts and culture reporter here at Aspen Public Radio. It is Monday, July 3rd. And last week, innovators and changemakers from all over the world gathered here for the 2017 Aspen Ideas Festival to discuss the issues impacting society today. Politics were at the forefront of the conversations on health, technology, and the arts. Damian Wetzel is director of the Aspen Institute Arts Program. He says he sees contemporary politics as an informant to culture.
That's what I want to bring here. I want that idea to be out in front so that people have a different level of understanding than simply being taught something, told something, read something, experience something.
Wetzel was recently named the Juilliard School's 7th president. He says he still plans to be with the Institute for one more Ideas Fest. So, plenty of time to hear more from him later. On this week's episode, the visionary behind the new dystopian play, Building the Wall, discusses his motive and intention behind its rapid worldwide rollout. Then, fellow journalist and podcast co-host for the show In the Thick joins me in analyzing the play's impact on society today. And details on what's happening in the arts world this week in the Valley. Thanks for tuning in and stay with me.
So we'll start from, so you got into him, Trump, and take it through, no, that would be later. Go.
Okay. The new play Building the Wall got its world premiere back in March. We'll hear more from the play's creator in a bit. But first, this audio comes from a rehearsal before said world premiere with the Fountain Theater in Los Angeles. The scene you're about to hear stars Judith Moreland and Beau Foxworth.
So you got into him, Trump.
I went to a rally. I don't really know why, I guess I just thought it'd be fun, you know? And I was kind of curious. So he did a rally in Dallas on my day off.
And you switched companies now. You're working for a new private prison company, Magnum Security.
Yeah, Magnum.
Why?
Because they offered me a raise and more responsibility overseeing the new facility outside El Paso. So I went to the rally, and it was amazing. I felt comfortable there.
Comfortable? Why?
I looked around and I saw a lot of people who looked like me. Just ordinary people. People with families.
White. White people.
Yeah, I guess. Mostly, sure.
Christian.
What's wrong with that?
Nothing.
No, the way you asked that, it seemed like there is. And I wonder about that. I got to wondering about that at that rally. I mean, if you can have gay pride and black pride and trans whatever pride, why can't I be proud to be white? Why can't I be proud to be Christian? Who speaks up for us anymore? And it seemed like he did. Trump. He would say these things, kind of edgy, you know, things you are not supposed to say. And he would say them and you could feel the crowd. You could feel the crowd kind of jump. Because a line had been crossed. Or a line you had been told all your life you couldn't cross. And now here it had been crossed in public. And Latin hadn't come down and struck this guy. In fact, he looked really happy. And then you could feel the crowd relax, like this enormous weight had been taken off their shoulders. And then there would be this little electric thrill, like, I don't know, like when you were a kid and you did something you had been told was wrong, but you did it anyway, that little jolt. And then the crowd would get really lively, and they would start shouting back at him, and that would work him up and back and forth, and it was like being part of a wave or something. Bigger than yourself. You didn't feel little anymore. You didn't feel put down anymore. Shamed. You didn't feel shamed anymore.
What about the violence at his rallies? Saying Hillary should be locked up or taken care of by those Second Amendment people. Asking the crowd whether non-Christians should be allowed to stay. Keeping out, even arresting certain reporters. Protesters getting beaten up.
Hey, those guys were there to provoke people and they succeeded. I mean, the whole thing was all kind of, I don't know, like pro wrestling thing, you know, a performance.
Some people got really hurt.
Nobody died.
No, that would come later.
Denver's Curious Theater Company was second in the country to run a production of the play, which the cast revived in Aspen last week. The Institute featured playwright Robert Shankin with artistic director Chip Walton and the cast, who all participated in a panel conversation after the performance. Last week, Shankin stopped by the studio to continue the discussion. What motivated you to write the play Building the Wall?
I wrote Building the Wall in October of last year. This would be just before the election. And even though I, like a lot of people, anticipated a different outcome, even then I was extremely concerned and upset because I felt that we'd already crossed a line in this country, that we'd done damage. And I was concerned about what this might mean for the future of our republic. It wasn't just the incendiary and consciously racist appeal by the then Republican candidate in terms of border security and illegal immigration so much as the way in which otherwise mature, responsible individuals in positions of power, both in journalism and in the political world, tried to rationalize or defend or explain away these comments, what I like to think of as normalizing the abnormal. You heard things like, oh, he doesn't mean it. It's just campaign rhetoric. It's just words. And of course, words matter. Words matter an awfully lot. And I sat down and I wrote this play as a, what if you took this language and its intention to a logical, if horrific, conclusion? There's precedent for this, of course. George Orwell did this in 1984. Margaret Atwood does this with The Handmaid's Tale, the creation of a future dystopia predicated on current political events. And I sat down and wrote this play called Building the Wall. And its first reading was in New York on December 1st. And its first production was in Los Angeles on March 11th. And that's how fast this rolled out.
So did you write this in sort of a fury?
Absolutely. I wrote it in a white-hot fury, but I have rolled it out in a very deliberate and quite intentional process, which is distinctly different than my normal production process, or really pretty much any writer's method of bringing a play to the marketplace. Typically, with a new work, a world premiere, I would huddle with my agent. We would discuss what kind of play this is, what sort of future it should have. And then working backwards from there, define a trajectory that would bring it in. It's very carefully managed, and you're trying to protect the piece. I did the exact opposite of that. Called up my agent and said, I want this play out there now. I want it produced widely, and I want it licensed indiscriminately. That is, anybody who wants to do it can do it. Professional theaters, non-professional theaters, semi-professional theaters, community theaters. And after my representative got over his initial shock, he eagerly embraced that, and that's exactly what we've done. And just in the last 3-4 months, this play has seen productions in Los Angeles and Denver and New York and Washington, D.C. and Portland, Oregon. And there are productions scheduled in Santa Fe, Tucson, Miami, Chicago, Michigan, Alpine, Texas, Ottawa, Mexico, Costa Rica. We're negotiating in London. There'll be a production in Vienna, and it's currently running in Tehran. And I certainly have never done anything like this. But this, as I say, was quite intentional. I feel a very much a sense of urgency as an artist and as a citizen to respond in the moment to what is happening. And one of the questions that I frequently get asked is this an anti-Trump play? And the answer is no. Trump is not a character in the play. He's only referred to by name, I think, 3 or 4 times. Because the political crisis we're facing right now, Trump is certainly the poster child for it. But this is not, even though it is often presented this way, a partisan crisis. That is to say, a crisis between Republicans and Democrats or liberals and conservatives. What we're experiencing is the resurgence of an authoritarian impulse. And we are not alone in this. All of the Western democracies are currently struggling with this. So the Brexit debacle in the United Kingdom, Le Pen in France, Five Star in Italy, Wilders in Holland, all of the Western democracies are struggling with this nativist populist movement, which has been taken advantage of, in my opinion, by authoritarian individuals. So this is an old playbook. You know, this is not new. And we're just experiencing it here in the United States after a very long period of absence, and so long that many people don't remember it. And that's why the play speaks to all these foreign countries, because they too are wrestling with this same issue.
What has been your perception of people that would be considered minorities in the United States? What has been their reaction or response to the play?
Since the election, we've seen a clear rise in the number of hate crimes against both racial minorities and religious minorities. It's almost as if these people now feel empowered to speak and to act. I think there's a very clear correlation between this resurgence of hate crime and the policies and rhetoric of the current administration. And minorities, those people who have been attending the production of this, feel that very keenly and feel that the play speaks to this in a very genuine manner. And although the tone is certainly cautionary, they don't feel that it is unnecessarily alarmist.
How have you seen politics become more apparent in art since the election?
Well, I mean, I think politics has taken such center stage right now in every aspect. I mean, it just dominates the news and the news cycle to such a degree that it can't help but affect everything else around it. And the arts are no different in that regard. However, the arts, and in particular theater, I think, is designed expressly for these moments of political crisis, social crisis, and individual introspection. Theater is, as an art form, is about this ritual of a group of individuals, strangers largely to each other, who gather together in a dark room in an event that will only be produced exactly like this one time and one time only. And in that moment, they create a kind of community that is reflective of the larger community, the polis, the state. And they have come together to hear a story about their community, and a story which reflects back to them their place within the community, their relationship within the community, and their relationship with each other. These two elements, community and story, are at the heart of the theatrical experience and what makes it so uniquely important right now during this political crisis. One of the ways in which you could frame the conflict that we are having is that it is a struggle over the narrative. It is a struggle over the story of America. That is, who are we? When we say we the people, what do we mean? Who is the people and who is not the people? Who better to engage in a struggle over the narrative than theater? And that's why I, as a theater artist, felt compelled to write this play and to bring it out so quickly. And I feel a similar sense of urgency and vigor among my peers. I'm not the only one who feels this. I'm not the only one who's responding to it in the moment.
And what do you want people to take away from this play?
You know, like all good plays, what I hope that Building the Wall will do is pose good questions, not provide simple answers. A good play should engage the audience emotionally, get them caught up in the events to which they are a witness. It should provoke them into some deeper and more complicated engagement with the issues of the play and hopefully, by extension, how those issues are manifesting themselves in their own lives, in the lives of their families and in their communities. A good play lives on well after the performance, not just in the conversations that it sparks immediately thereafter, but in your dream life, in your reverie, in your thinking, in your molecular structure. A good play turns the lake over, as it were, and hopefully brings us into a deeper sense of connection with what we're feeling and with the issues with which we're struggling.
You're listening to Curated on Aspen Public Radio. That was Robert Schenken, the award-winning playwright behind the new play Building the Wall. Now we turn to Julio Ricardo Varela, who co-hosts the new political podcast In the Thick and writes for Latino USA. He joined me last week to talk about the play and the implications it may have on Aspen audiences and beyond.
You know, art always takes you to the most extreme places, but it's based in reality. It's not as far-fetched as you can. Now, are we massively rounding up immigrants right now in the United States? No. But are we seeing sort of an increase in enforcement and rounding up and sort of this cavalier attitude by federal agents about, like, this is what we're supposed to do, like, get out the way, and, like, that, and, you know, I'm doing the job, like, I'm an American, and this is what I'm, yes, like, it's, ICE has become more, like, publicly into enforcement ever since Donald Trump became president, and they were kind of doing the same things under Obama, but they were kind of doing it, you know, behind the door. And now it's kind of like they've expressed like their public love for the president and sort of like, this is what we're supposed to do. So that has consequences. I mean, that has a lot of consequences. And so it's not that far-fetched.
What are some of those consequences?
The notion of who is a criminal, you know, that's really... That digs deep, and it's one of the things that we talked about at Aspen last week when we did In the Thick with Jose Antonio Vargas, Wajahat Ali, and Mariana Hossa. We did it at the Regis. It was awesome.
Yeah, yeah.
And but it's the notion of who's a criminal, right? So I think a lot of people don't realize that immigrants, you know, if you really go back before 1924, and, you know, if I'm sure you've probably heard people say, like, well, my grandparents came legally from Europe, anyone could have come into the United States before, like, the 20s. Like, as long as you were, like, healthy, you didn't need a green card. You just showed up. The United States needed labor. You didn't have to sign. You had no papers. Like, as long as you weren't, like had measles or, like, weren't able-bodied, you wouldn't come in. So this notion of, like, immigrants, the legality of it has become more and more complicated. So if you look at the history, as this country has gotten browner, it's become more immigrant restrictive. And it really came to a boil after Ronald Reagan signed the amnesty bill in 86. And then about 10 years later, a non-Republican, President Bill Clinton, pretty much ran on border enforcement and proudly bragged to the American public that he deported more people than any other person in the country.
So what you're saying is this is a bipartisan issue.
Absolutely bipartisan. Has 20 to 30 years of history. Clinton was running against Bob Dole and was basically saying similar things than Donald Trump was saying in 2016, 2017. So you get 96 and then 9/11 happened, right? So then all of a sudden we became this sort of enforcement, you know, no one can come into this country, you know, rah, 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 America. Let's go to war. Like, and we all know what, you know, we don't, you know, like we're still dealing with those issues. Right?
Because there's this huge sense of fear that's developed. Out
exactly.
Of that.
Like, you know, there's a reason why Donald Trump's rhetoric worked, because a lot of people believed it. So when he said most of them are rapists and criminals, Mexicans, you know, let's build a wall, it resonated with people because it's this fear. It's like this sense of, like, Bill Clinton's telling you about, like, the marauding invaders. So this is just a whole, like, final perfect storm consequence of how both Democrats and Republicans have painted immigrants that aren't from places that traditionally America was built on. And the American public has allowed for it. Mm-hmm. And so to really get back to, like, a play about a concentration camp with immigrants, not that far-fetched. And guess what? We've kind of done it already before with the Japanese internment.
Right.
So it's like no one would be like, hey, would it be too far-fetched if we rounded up all these Japanese Americans and put them in concentration camps? People would be like, no, but it happened. So there are incidents in American history that it's happened. So I don't think it's far-fetched. I think the play definitely, you know, you use art to get to people to think about it and get to start going, oh, well, you're being ridiculous. No, I don't think you are being ridiculous, right? And I think the Latin American, the Latino community in this country has been saying this, and they've been ignored. So what you see now is this sense of discovery, this sense of like, wow, something's up, but is it too late, right? Are we actually living that play? You know, that's the big question.
Okay, so since Trump came out with this executive order with the mm-hmm. travel ban, what have you and your colleagues seen? What is the vibe that you and your colleagues have seen among immigrants in
fear.
The United States?
Like legitimate, hardcore fear.
So, like, would you say it's like the same kind of fear that people that voted for Trump would feel?
I think it's worse because, you know, there's... You know, you're dealing lives at stake. I think people that might have are afraid of a Trump administration, you know, where as American citizens, most of us can still, you know, not worry about being taken away. Right. We're not looking over our shoulders, even though it's really important. This is a really important point that I don't want to overlook. Right now, the levels of arrests of immigrants being arrested by ICE are about the same as 2014 under Barack Obama.
Okay.
So that's my whole point. It's like this has been going on, but now the American media kind of wakes up to it and goes, oh, here's a problem. And I think there's interest and people start asking the question, is the fear more palpable? Yes. But are there many, like, are there thousands of immigrant families that have been living sort of quote unquote, in fear in the shadows for years? Yes. Right. So it's an important point to make. Mm-hmm. So I don't want to turn this into like ever since Trump became president, like life for immigrants has been horrible. Life for immigrants has been horrible for a while, at least for undocumented community. And yes, Donald Trump's rhetoric is beyond bigoted, beyond xenophobic. I get it. But it just didn't happen out of nowhere. Right. And I think that's the big question, that this is sort of a something that has progressed and we've kind of like as Americans kind of let it be because we haven't let voices into the conversation more willingly.
One of the main characters of the play, his name is Rick. He was one of the head guards in a prison essentially. And he's in prison in 2019 mm-hmm. awaiting trial for this concentration camp that was started essentially under his watch. In the play, he takes the same stance as his superiors until people start dying.
Right.
I want to ask, like, where is the line for people that are following orders like that?
I don't think the line's there yet. That's the problem. I think there's plenty of people in this country who aren't going to take news from, you know, they're only going to get news from one source and they're going to be like, good, like, send them back. We should have done this a long time ago without understanding that we created this. Mm-hmm. And now you're just getting played. You're just getting played by, manipulated by media, manipulated by politicians to get, you know, some cheap, like, approval ratings. And at the same time, families are getting separated and lives are being destroyed.
Right.
And you know, I wish this play, you know, I for one, hope that play stays fiction. But it's not too outrageous.
So this is going to be my last question.
Okay.
How effective of a tool do you think that this play could be to affect change and, well, start dialogue and potentially affect change?
That's a great question because, okay, because I will be critical a little bit about the play.
Yeah.
Is that I think it looks too much in through the lens of what I think is wrong with America, is that we're still having a conversation with not everyone at the table in the terms of like this sense of immigration and Muslim bans are still kind of being controlled by the mainstream, mostly white male straight media. I'm just going to be really honest with that. And I get in trouble with it, but that's what it is. It's like now this idea has been validated. and now it's going to, you know, be successful, when in fact there's plenty of works and there's plenty of creative spaces that have been exploring this forever. But, you know, it's kind of this double-edged sword for me, because I know it's an important topic, but I don't know if the playwrights really lived it. I don't know if the playwrights really, like, understood 30 years of American, like, bipartisan criminalization of the Latin American community in this country. And I don't know if you live as a Muslim. And I have plenty of Muslim journalists who, post 9/11, like, they can just fill books about how they have to live in this country. And these are American citizens. So, in essence, I just want to make sure that it doesn't come across as sort of like what I say is like the white savior, like, coming in to solve the problem for everybody. When in fact, we've been like, we, POC, people of color, have been talking about this issue, and we're kind of like, hey, criminalization, it's been going on. You know, I think we all need to be part of the conversation. So I hope that I welcome this, because I get to be very honest, like, in this conversation, and not totally praise it. Yes, allies need to be had in terms of to try to look at immigration in a more holistic, more realistic way for America, seeing it more of a benefit as opposed to a national security threat. I get it. Totally get it. But let's make sure that the voices that have been saying that aren't ignored and are not going to be forgotten as that debate continues to grow.
Julio Ricardo Varela co-hosts the new political podcast, In the Thick. He was in town last week for the Aspen Ideas Festival. In the Thick can be found on the Apple Podcasts app, iTunes, and online at inthethick.org. Here's what else is happening this week in the Valley. Tonight, the Wheeler Opera House's Sunset Sessions continues with Writ Large, a spoken word story event told in front of a live audience. That starts at 8 p.m. Showings of Theater Aspen's main stage production of the musical Hairspray will take place Monday and Wednesday at 7:30 p.m., July 4th at 6:30 p.m., and Saturday, July 8th at 3 and 8 p.m. Monday and Tuesday, Thievery Corporation will be playing Belly Up Aspen with Denver's Late Night Radio at 9:30 p.m. Wednesday through Saturday, the Aspen Art Museum will be hosting mandala sand painting with Tibetan monks. Also on Thursday, the Snowmass Free Concert Series continues with bluegrass band Head for the Hills beginning at 5:30 p.m. Friday, the Carbondale Clay Center presents the opening reception for Points of Cadence at 6 p.m., a solo exhibition of ceramic and fiber art by resident artist Colette Spears. Theater Aspen's production of the play Sex with Strangers will open at the Hearst Theater in Aspen at 8 p.m., also on Friday. And on Sunday at 4 p.m., the Aspen Festival Orchestra will take the stage at the Benedict Music Tent with conductor Michael Stern and pianist Yefim Bronfman. Following that event, at 6:30 p.m., the Salon Signature Sing for Your Life will feature bass baritone Ryan Speedo Green performing, with a panel discussion afterwards to follow in the Pepke Auditorium. That's all that's curated this week. For more on arts and culture, tune into Morning Edition throughout the week from 6 to 9 a.m. and visit us online at aspenpublicradio.org, where all episodes of this show live. I produced today's show with help from Kristen Kay. It was edited by Carolyn Zachariasen. Greg Lau and Jason Patton of Boulder wrote the show's theme tune, Omnicord Entrance. Special thanks to the Stefan Edlis and Gail Neeson Foundation, which aims to support the arts, community, and outreach. Be sure to follow Curated APR on Facebook for news and updates on arts in the Valley. I'm Claire Woodcock at the Edlis Neeson Arts and Culture Desk. Curated is a production of Aspen Public Radio News.